WRCO, WRCE Radio, the home of the morning show here on the radio. And we love to have various topics on there. And one of my favorite subjects, my favorite guests are those that write books, because I'm always fascinated by that and the ability to be able to put something down on paper. So joining us today is Terry Berg, who has just recently completed and released a book called Amalgamated. And Terry joins us in the studios today. Terry, if you want to slide that microphone a little closer here, we'll get you up and talk a little bit about this new book. This is pretty outstanding for you. I understand it's your first book.
It is. I don't think I have that many books in me. I mean, that took 8 years to get this one out.
So you're a one-hit wonder, in other words, maybe.
Well, I don't know about the wonder, but I'm a one-hit.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Chicago, Illinois. And I always like to say you can't grow up all the way in Chicago because it's so crowded and so relatively insane that I had to come out here to finish.
I see. but you've traveled, and of course you spent a lot of time in the Caribbean too.
Just 1 year, and then visiting a number of times after I lived there for that 1 year, yeah.
Okay. So when you were growing up, what did your parents want you to do for an occupation?
Well, you know, I come from a Jewish heritage, so you had to be either a doctor or a lawyer. You could be some other professional, but those were the most popular. So your parents could say, my son the doctor, my son the lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So come from that heritage, but I wasn't that interested in being a doctor or a lawyer. So I just did, you know, stumble through life like most people when they're in their teens and their 20s.
Growing up in that heritage, though, it gave you an appreciation for hard work and, you know, family and things.
Oh, yeah. My dad was a hard worker. He had a small business with his brothers. They had two stores in Chicago. Berg Sales, like a wholesale store at that time, before they had things like Malwart and all the other big ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did. He worked a lot. So did his brothers. They had a car that they shared, a 1949 Cadillac that they bought in 1953 or something. And then each uncle in the family got the car for a week, drove each other together to work.
Well, yeah. Living in the city like that, you don't need a car quite as much as you do out here, do you?
Oh, that's true. Chicago's big, not quite like New York, but like New York, I think maybe half the people don't even have cars because they don't need them. And you could get by in Chicago if you lived in the main city itself, of course, with the suburbs that all changed in the 50s and 60s.
Visiting both cities, and especially New York, I think if your car doesn't have a horn, you don't want to drive it, because everybody honks their horn, it seems like.
Yeah, it's a requirement.
It's a requirement. And speaking of which, in that traffic, you drove bus through that madness, too, didn't you?
No, that was in Milwaukee.
Oh, that was actually in Milwaukee.
Yeah, the book makes it sound like it could be Chicago.
Right.
But there's a couple of references, and it was Milwaukee.
Okay. But that's not an easy task either, is it?
It looks a lot easier than it is.
It does.
Because, you know, you just see a guy sitting there. He's in control. He looks calm. But there's a lot of things going on. Carpal tunnel stuff, back problems, liver problems. They didn't used to have seats that had air cushioning.
Okay.
So they were pretty rough riding.
In the book, you describe the bus times and the stress you were under to get there, you know, and not be late or early. I had no idea that it was that strenuous and pressure was on.
That's interesting. Yeah, people don't really have an idea what those guys and women are going through. But the people who have been around a long time, if you've been there 20 years or so, you can get your own route. Otherwise, you're just driving everybody's day off, vacation, whatever. And when you have your own route, then they don't use the clock hardly at all. When you're first driving or when you're substituting for people who are driving, you have to watch your watch all the time, make sure you're not early or late. You can be late, but it's terrible to be early.
So early is worse than late as a bus driver there in the city.
Oh, yeah, because you miss your connections with other buses. So people going to work or shopping or wherever they're going, they depend on a schedule on don't know if this is true in Chicago, if they have schedules, because it's a little more insane over there. But in Milwaukee at that time in the 70s, you could kind of depend on the schedule to tell you when your bus was coming. So buses that were going east and west met with buses going north and south. People exchanged on buses. If you were a minute early, you'd miss that bus that was you're supposed to meet. So you couldn't be more than a minute early. If you were, you had to sit at that light until you were on time, which your passengers usually didn't like. You know.
I bet. Bad weather probably made it a challenge, too, when you had a lot of snow, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, the buses are pretty good with the snow and stuff. The severe cold is what would get you, because the door is always opening and closing, you know, if you're a driver. And when it's 10, 20 below, you have a hard time keeping warm.
I bet.
So if you're driving 3 or 4 hours or more, it can be miserable.
Now, did you have an assistant on the bus to help you take the fares and things like that?
No.
No?
There was something called a platform instructor. When you first started, he would sit behind you and help you through the day for a week or two, I think it was. But other than that, no. It wasn't like the old trolleys, which they did have fare people in the back and the driver in the front. But the driver handled all this stuff. But there was a fare box, and people put their stuff in the fare box. And you could look in there and see if it was the right fare, and then you just flip a switch and dump down into this container at the bottom of the fare box. And then you handed out transfers, and sometimes you gave directions, and sometimes you had to listen to someone who wanted to give you a bad time. You know,
I was going to say, you probably had to put up with a little bit of that. Were you ever fearful that somebody's going to rob you or anything like that?
Well, there was nothing much to rob. You couldn't get the fare box.
I see.
You know, because it was locked in. And no bus driver carries very much on him, you know. So robbery wasn't a problem, but there's always some rebellious young people or older people, and you have to deal with that. I taught in what we called an alternative high school before that, so I had some experience with people who were feisty.
We have alternative high schools now.
I heard you have one.
Yeah, they've been kind of expanding on those, but I don't know if they're probably the same idea, but may have been a little different when you taught.
It's pretty much the same from what I've heard. At that time, and this was 71, let's see, was it? No, that was more like 79. In the 70s, they used to kick girls out of school if they got pregnant. Didn't want them around, bad influence. And there were some kids who were too wily for handling, and they would be kicked out of school. So that's how the alternative school started in Milwaukee. And it was supported by Pius XI Catholic Church. So it actually was held in a building in their courtyard, and 4 teachers, 45 students.
Mm-hmm. So having been, you've always been kind of a people person, you know, you went from bus driving to that. It was probably, you know, pretty good for you, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting, but I wasn't always a people person. I was confused by people when I was young.
Okay.
I mean, they would say things, and I didn't know why they would say something like that, or they would act a certain way, and it wasn't the way they felt, and I kind of was a little shy till I was, you know, like in my 20s. But I wanted to get over it, too. I wanted to understand what was going on, so I studied animals.
I see. The book is called Amalgamated. Terry Berg is our guest. And I guess explain the title and where you came up with that, Terry.
Oh, Amalgamated. Well, that's taken from one of the two major stories in there called... at the bus company, the union was called the Amalgamated Transit Union. ATU. So I just grabbed that because it was about the bus company, but it was in the union, but it was also about putting things together. Amalgamated means combined, put together, working together, hopefully. When I was a little kid, I passed by a statue about 5 blocks from my house that had all these people kind of mashed together. doing something together in this bronze statue and piled up high, and they were doing something. And I saw the thing there when I was about 12, Amalgamated Transit Union, you know. And that kind of fascinated me.
Did you think that's going to be a book title someday?
No. Didn't think that.
Yeah. Did you ever think that the life that you led could lead to a book someday?
Oh, I think a third of the people at least want to write a book or wish they could write a book. I mean, I think that's a fantasy for a lot of people.
I think it is.
Yeah. So, can't say I really thought I would, you know, but things happen.
Things got interesting, and, you know, it's kind of a parallel thing. You know, you're talking about, as you read the book, your life and you're driving bus, and all of a sudden you're in the Caribbean and you're watching you're watching primates, you know, and it's kind of this, you know, we have a little bit more in common sometimes with the primates than we think, don't we?
Yeah, well, I think we do. Yeah, and the more we understand other animals, the more we realize the commonalities and the kind of consciousness that animals have.
So tell me how you wound up there and you know, your study and your interest in animals.
Well, when I was a kid, I liked animals. And Chicago doesn't have a lot of wild animals there except for the people. But I lived near the lake and parks, so I would go out and look at insects and things, and we would fish in Lake Michigan, too. So I liked animals, and I brought them home. And my mother was tolerant, which was surprising, but she was very tolerant of my curiosity and my liking and interest in animals. So she let me do that. I would raise tadpoles into frogs, and I would have snakes, and I would raise mice to feed the snakes. I don't know how she did that, you know. You would never guess from the kind of person she was that she would tolerate that in a high-rise building, you know, small apartment in Chicago. But she did, and so I followed that, ended up working at Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago.
Okay. And then how did you connect with
the Caribbean? So I kept liking animals, and I ended up wanting to work in a laboratory which was studying the behavior of, they were crab-eating macaques, that kind of monkey, right, called. So I worked with a really good person, Raith Carr, and we studied laboratory animals. They were confined in cages. Some were raised in isolation to see what effect that would have on them. Some of my bosses' other cohorts would do operations on animals' brains to see what it did. We were working in Illinois State Pediatric Institute, which dealt with a lot of kids that had metabolic problems, brain damage problems, and they couldn't live at home. They were living in this hospital situation. So these, quote, scientists were doing operations on animals, monkeys' brains, to see what it would affect their behavior. So to try to compare them to the kids who had brain problems to see what kind of, this is before they had imaging that could, and electronics that could read the brain better. But eventually, there was less and less tolerance for that kind of experimentation on animals. So they decided to go to the Caribbean, which had no restraints on them. In the Caribbean, they were glad to have scientists and their money. And so they established an outpost in the Caribbean. I heard about it, and they told me they just wanted to study the behavior of monkeys, and that sounded good to me. So I volunteered for the subject, for the project.
And when you moved there, you were kind of on your own going out and kind of watching and viewing every day, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting that way. Started out where they gave me a boat. I was supposed to go out in the ocean and go to the end of the island, which is about 4 or 5 miles away, because there was no actual road, although you could get there if you had a rover, you know, a Land Rover. It was an English colony island for a long time, so they had English stuff there, Land Rovers, and you could bump over these outrageous boulder roads, and you could get this 4 or 5 miles. You could get out there in a couple hours, you know, but that wasn't a good way to go. So they gave me this little boat with a motor, and I was supposed to go out in the ocean. But that didn't really work very well. It was rainy season when I got there, and there was a lot of storms and things. And it was not practical. So I ended up studying kind of mid-island that was undeveloped there.
And then you actually, the primates recognized you, right? You were there?
After a while. You know, I mean, because there were people kind of coming and going. There were people kind of living there part-time or working out there, making charcoal to sell and making rum from sugar cane. And they had their little things to do out there. Not many people lived out there, though, until they started developing the island more. And now it's a little more like Disneyland, you know.
So when you're there, you have a realization somewhere along the line that, you know, things weren't going well, like the scientists that were there, and I mean...
Well, yeah. They wanted me to set up feeding stations so I could watch the animals, they thought.
Okay,
so I set up this box feeding stations, and the animals came, and all they did was fight, you know, over this feeding station. And it wasn't a natural situation. So I kind of gave up on that, and they didn't say anything, and I didn't know what they were up to, but they eventually were up to studying them to find out where they were, what they did, and how they could catch them so they could build a big enclosure and do brain studies on them again. And, you know, I didn't realize they were going to do that. They didn't tell me they were going to do that. So I just studied them and gave them the information, and then they realized they weren't going to get out of me what they really wanted, I think.
Sure.
So.
Then you moved away from that then. You went back to visit a few times, though.
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, I knew people there. I liked the people there. It was really interesting. It was a natural setting. I was always attracted to more natural settings, even in Chicago. Luckily, I lived by the lake and parks. So I had some of that in Chicago, but I really wanted to be in a more natural setting. That's why we're out here, really, you know, compared to Chicago or even Milwaukee.
People actually hunted the primates, and some of the locals ate the meat.
Monkey meat, she's sweet, boy.
I know. He was monkey meat, she's sweet.
She's sweet,
boy. Did you ever try monkey meat?
No, I wasn't there to eat my monkeys. It seemed to be in juxtaposition in a bad way with what I was doing. So, I mean, it was interesting. But another interesting thing is that the African green vervets are a very common monkey in most of Africa. But the AIDS epidemic started with contact with the African green vervet monkeys. They carry it. So there was another good reason not to eat monkey.
Yeah, I would say. Do those kind of experiments still go on there? Do they still have scientists do they?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I haven't been there in about 8-9 years now. So I'm guessing they're still there, you know, as long as the government lets them do that. And they do, you know. It's a different kind of government. It's an Afro-Caribbean people that were brought over as slaves. And they rebelled against the English government because the working in the cane fields was so brutal. You know, if you cut off your hand, then you lost your job.
Yeah.
So they kind of rebelled on workmen's rights compensation, and England gave them certain rights to control government. They didn't give up any of their land, which the English owned all the land, but they gave up some control over government. So
while you were there, you had a chance to attend a music festival. I think I read that in the book, and that interested me a little bit. Can you tell a little bit about that story?
Sure. Well, it started out by me getting scurvy. So I would go out and watch the monkeys, and I would go out with a canteen of lime juice. And I would drink the lime juice, and I had a World War I canteen that I carried out with me, and I got sick after a while. And I found out later that the lime from the lime juice was interacting with the aluminum, and I was just consuming aluminum citrate or some kind of poison. And so I got scurvy. I couldn't use the lime, you know, because it was being used up by the aluminum. So I had to go somewhere, because they had one doctor, and he was very old, and he kind of like didn't believe in a lot of things that medical science believes in. So I had to go to Puerto Rico to find out how I could treat this thing. So while I was in Puerto Rico taking care of my scurvy, scurvy made it so I had sores on my feet, and I couldn't get out for a couple of weeks because of these sores on my feet.
Tough to walk then.
Tough to walk, couldn't study out there. So I went to Puerto Rico. While I was there, they had a rock festival with a lot of American, famous American groups came there like they did for rock festivals in the 70s. So I decided I would visit the rock festival out there too. Yeah, that was.
And you were actually, some of the band members were around you, right? Kind of unbeknownst to you? Were you in kind of the backstage area and things?
No, I was kind of in the midst of it like other people. It wasn't a real big gathering. It wasn't like Woodstock, you know, but it was thousands of people. And yeah, the band people were around, and I didn't know if they were, except for that one story where I was somehow working with a booth kind of that was selling drinks and different stuff, and they asked me to carry $400 over the hill. They didn't want to build up too much money at once at this booth, so every once in a while they'd send somebody over with money, cash it away somewhere, so they weren't carrying thousands of dollars. So I got elected somehow. I was involved and carried the money over the hill. I'm going over the hill, and I'm thinking, wow, I could walk out of here with $400. In the 70s, $400 was like a couple thousand dollars now, you know. But I decided I didn't want to be on the run. So I went over there, gave them the money, came back, and I passed these guys who were laughing hysterically in a high-pitched voice, sitting on tanks of something. And I looked at them, and they're laughing, and helium tanks, they're inhaling this helium and smoking something that smelled a lot like marijuana. And they're motioning me, come on over, you know. I'm like, I don't think so, you know. Thanks, but no thanks. It looked a little too crazy for me.
They liked the helium, and it was changing their voices.
Yeah.
Good thing it didn't blow up on them, though.
Yeah, I guess the helium isn't so bad. I think hydrogen is worse.
Hydrogen. Yeah, yeah, it would be. But the law, I mean, the policing there and things like that. I think you told a story about, didn't you lose an item and it was picked up by...
Yes, I left my canteen at the booth when I took the money over to the hill. And somebody liked the look of my canteen. It was a desperado. These were the police there. They had these guys on horses in Puerto Rico. They were on horses, and they were supposed to keep the peace there. And one of them picked up the canteen because they liked it, and they were riding around on the horse, you know. And they passed me by, and I saw my canteen there, and I said, hey, that's my canteen. And I grabbed it off there, not knowing what I was doing, you know. But they were more surprised by what I did, and they just, you know, they just left.
Yeah. I would have been fearful to do that, thinking that, you know, maybe you're going to get clubbed or something.
Well, I was stupid. And I liked my canteen.
Was that the one that gave you scurvy, though?
Yeah, it was. Right. That's my I still have that.
Do you really?
I don't drink from it, though.
You don't put lime in it anymore, though.
Not anymore.
Yeah, you learned your lesson. The book is called Amalgamated. Terry Berg is our guest, and we'll have more coming up on The Morning Show from WRCO. Our guest is Terry Berg. Amalgamated is the name of the book that we're discussing here. Kind of a little bit of a history of your life. It's kind of like did you keep a diary?
No. I just picked two stories that I liked.
Okay.
You know, and didn't really mean it to be autobiography or there's another word that's used for somebody who writes a book all about themselves.
Right.
I don't use that word.
But you're kind of in the third person? Is that the way to describe it?
I broke it up into two books. It's really one, but the first book I used a third person, named him Connie, because I didn't think I wanted to write a whole book. I did, but by the time I got about a third of the way through the book, I decided to use the first person. And, you know, it made it a little more personal for me, and I identified it with it a little more. And so it's two books, one's third person, one's first person.
And there are some poems in there.
Yeah, I picked a few of my poems, and somebody else's poem, too, I think. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Nature Boy. The poem Nature Boy.
Eden Abez, the song Nature Boy. Nat King Cole made that famous.
Yeah. And I really liked that when I was a kid, you know, because I was into animals and nature a lot. So I knew that one. So that's in the book, too. But the other poems are ones that I wrote.
You found a few pictures, actual photographs to put in there.
I kept some from there. They were 2.25 by 2.25 pictures. You know, that I had like almost a brownie camera when I was there. So I kept some of those and got them in there just to show what the Caribbean looked like at the time in that town, on that place.
It was more of a commitment back then because you had to have film developed and those kind of things.
They had a little drugstore in town, and he did send out film, Agfa film. I think it's probably more popular in Europe and England, because I don't remember Agfa film when I was growing up in Chicago. And he would develop the pictures for me, and then sometimes I developed them myself, because you can do contact printing where you have the paper, you have the negative over the paper, and then you put the light through it, and so the contact between the negative and the paper is right there, and you get the same size picture as the negative is. When I was a kid, they used to have these things you could buy in the store, and they were negatives of golf players, Arnold Palmer and all the other guys of that time, and they had these little negatives, and they had this little cardboard thing, and you stuck the paper in there, and then you stuck the negative in there, you held it up to the sun for like 1.5 minutes, then took it out, and you had a picture from the negative.
I don't ever remember that. Why didn't they just sell the picture?
Oh, because it was fun to make a picture.
Fun to make a picture, okay.
Not that I played golf or knew about them. But
sure. You had like golf cards, or like baseball cards. You had your own golf card.
Kind of like that, yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. Moving on then, you know, later in life you had a chance to share your stories and your skills as a teacher, too.
Yeah. I was attracted to teaching, I guess. You know, that's a way to share yourself and your experiences and have contact with people, you know, who are learning. So there were younger people mostly. I did do some assistant teaching in a university, you know, under a full-time instructor. But mostly it was younger people. But, yeah, teaching is interesting.
What subjects did you teach then?
The main thing in the alternative high school in Milwaukee was science and math. So other teachers there were only four of us. There other teachers did English, you know, some did social studies. And, yeah, I was there for about 5 or 6 years with the kids there until the school eventually closed because the public schools were willing to take on their own kids that they had rejected and had their own alternative schools like we have finally here.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about, I know there was a struggle in the bus company in terms of rights for the drivers and things like that, and you were a real advocate trying to get things changed in that situation.
Well, I was real irritated to have to be joining the union without choice. My family was raised with a professional attitude to their children, you know. Even though my father wasn't a professional, still you wanted your kids to do well and, you know, and go to school and all that. He was first generation immigrant, you know, from Russia, and my mother's parents were from Germany, and they want their kids to get educated in the United States and become successful, and then they can brag about them. So, I forgot what your question was already.
About the being an advocate for the bus company and the rights of the workers and everything.
So I was interested in how the other half lived. That's what it looked like to me, you know, when you have a professional leaning or guidance from parents. I wonder what other people do, you know? What is it like to work, you know, for a living that's not professional? I was real curious. I wanted to do it. I wanted to see what it was like. So as my wanderings around, when I got tired of graduate school, I decided to join the bus company if I could. And they were a little reluctant to hire me. You won't like it here. You know, you can always do something else, so you probably won't stay very long, you know. But they needed a lot of people at that time. So, because the government was sponsoring the public bus companies and increasing the routes and the times that they were running, so they needed a lot of people. So they were hiring people like me, which they usually didn't hire. You know? They even hired black people, which was a real novelty for them
right.
in the 70s. Yeah, because there were no black drivers in the 70s till about 76 or 7 or 8.
And also, not only black drivers, but women drivers. Didn't hire them right away.
Yes, women drivers, too. The government gave them extra credit for hiring minorities, extra credit for women. The bus company would hire Afro-American women to get double credit because they were women and they were minorities.
Wow.
So people came in, you know, from all different kinds of walks of life that weren't there before then at all. Almost, I'd say the majority of the drivers before that were World War II veterans when I came in. Before that, maybe they were World War I veterans, I don't know. But they were white drivers. They had ammunition boxes that they carried back from their service, and they kept their lunch and possibly a gun in their ammunition box, because you could deal with a lot of things going through the inner city in Chicago or Milwaukee or wherever you were. And that was their signal, you know?
Hmm. Did you ever carry a gun?
No.
No?
No. My mouth is the only thing
You could talk your way out of it then.
Usually. Yeah. Sometimes it was too much, but, you know, once I stopped by a YMCA at 10:30 at night, and all the kids were getting out of some kind of, you know, community project. They always had kids coming into the YMCA, keep them off the streets. Some of these kids were so good. And they pile onto my buses, force their way through the back door and the front door. Of course, not paying any fare, you know, being wise, you know, as they can be. And it was just, you know, overwhelming sometimes. You know, you couldn't do too much about it if something like that happened. But other than that, I was usually able to handle situations okay.
Yeah. So you were told you're probably better off not to chase somebody down if they didn't pay a fare or whatever the case was.
No, the policy was you challenged the fare if they didn't put in a fare or enough fare. You challenge them once, and if they didn't pay it, you just let it go. That was everything. They don't want you to argue with people on the bus. You know, they would take the loss rather than, you know, get into a fuss with them.
I see. Growing up Jewish, you know, you were kind of a unique individual in that, you know, you were Jewish. Were you in a Jewish neighborhood when you were born?
There were a lot of Jewish people in that neighborhood, yeah. Mm-hmm. Most of them Reformed, but there was also a very Orthodox small shul temple in that area, too. We were the Reform movement. Which is like, I don't know how to describe it, except it's not old school Jewish. You know, it's like American, adapt to the new country Jewish, you know. And you don't talk about being Jewish either so much, you know. You can pass, right? It's not like you're real black, dark colored skin. You can pass. Some people kind of suspect you're Jewish, but, you know, you can pass as non-Jewish if you choose to. So a lot of people are quiet about being Jewish because there was a lot of prejudice in the 40s and 50s, especially. You know, it was kind of like the Afro-Americans where, you know, hotels didn't want to let you stay there, you know, if they knew you were Jewish. You know, so
you did see some of that prejudice firsthand then.
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah. I was in a mall once in downtown Milwaukee, and some kid comes up to me. He says, "Are you Jewish?" And I'm like, "What? You know, what are you asking me that?" "Well, I'm with my friends over there, and I saw you, and I said, I'll bet that guy's a Jew."
Man.
So he comes up to me. He has a bet with his friends that I'm a Jew.
So how did you respond then?
I said, "Forget it. Oh. You don't go up to people and do that." Yeah. Like that. So I don't know if he won his bet or not. I don't think so.
But now, living in the rural area, Jewish, you know, there are a few Jewish people around us here in this community.
There are, yeah. I think I found about 30 Jewish people within about 30 miles of Russian Center, because we get together sometimes and have gatherings for the different festivals and holidays.
Oh.
And a friend of mine, he's a rabbi from Milwaukee that I got to know there. He comes out, you know, and he gets together with us and we celebrate together. So, yeah, there's some Jewish stuff going on here. And I thought there would be more prejudice than I think there is here, because I was used to it in Chicago. And I thought, well, out here, there's not many Jewish people. But especially talking to people who work out here, people who work in the farms and stuff, and other people, they're pretty open. And when I was teaching in the school here, too, here and in Muscadet, the kids were good. They were curious about, oh, Jewish, you know, what is it, you know? And I always wear a hat, because if you're an observant Jew, in other words, you're observing all the traditions and the laws, the Bible, the Torah, then you wear a cap. It's called a kippah. And so that can identify you. And so when I was working in the schools, I started out wearing a hat like this, a good old farmer's hat or something. And the principal came up and said, this is in Richland Center. And he said, you can't wear a hat. That's you know, that's one of our policies. Kids don't wear hats. Nobody wears a hat in here. I said, well, I have to wear something like that because I'm Jewish. So I ditched the hat and I wore the kippah, which is a little skull cap type of thing. And that's when kids were really curious and would ask me about it. And I had a lot of fun with it after a while. You know, I kind of shed that thing in Chicago where you don't really talk about being Jewish, you know. And it was more fun because people were pretty good about it. I mean, there's a couple of people who have prejudices, but...
Yeah, but it was an education for the students because obviously they don't know a lot about it.
No, one of my kids went to school here. One of my kids was in class and his teacher was talking about Jewish people and stuff, but we don't have any Jews here. And he's like, excuse me? You know, I mean, she didn't know that we had Jews in Richland Center. And we have doctors and lawyers that are Jews in Richland Center. Mm-hmm. But they're quiet about it, usually, you know? They're from the city. Most of them came in the 70s, 60s and 70s, you know, back to the land.
Sure. And settled out here.
Yeah.
The book has amalgamated. Terry Berg is our guest, and we'll have a final word on our book and more about the conversation coming up here on The Morning Show. Our community conversation on the morning show, and guest Terry Berg in the studio talking about his book, Amalgamated. Tell me about the illustrations and your illustrator for the book.
Oh, yeah. So when I got through typing out this thing, well, I started out writing it by hand, and then I went over and over. I finally had to type it because I had to get it to somebody. They weren't going to read my handwriting, as you can see from that letter in there. So
Your illustrations.
The illustrations, yeah, there we are. Yeah. So we have a good friend, Pam and I, Dave Lachman, and he's an artist. He works for a successful professional artist doing some of his background work and doing other work for him. And so I asked him if he would be interested in doing it because I only had like 112 typewritten pages, and I thought, this is not really a book, but I'm finished. So I asked him if he would do some work. I thought that would be neat to collaborate and have something extra in the book. So he read the book and he liked it enough, so he decided, yeah, he would do it.
It's interesting because, as I mentioned earlier, you know, you're talking about your time in the Caribbean and your time, and again, it's an interesting parallel between those two things, although they didn't happen at the same time. It almost kind of reads like that.
Well, that's good, because when I was writing it, I was thinking, you know, what do they have in common? You know, how can I hop back and forth like that? And is there anything that relates them together? And then only after I finished it and everything, I realized, well, yeah, it's all about community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the union, all about community, and the monkeys, all about community, the government in St. Kitts, the Afro-Caribbean government, all about community, even though it's politics. Of course, every community is about politics, isn't it?
Well, it seems. But it's amazing how, you know, you talk about the vervets and how they act, and not unlike humans sometimes.
Much more like us than we used to think. But they don't have the same capacity to rule the world, you know. But like people, they can use up their environment and have nowhere to go, you know, or have to go somewhere where they can. And that's what people have done throughout history. They've used up their environment often, and they have to go somewhere else.
Yeah, they only can take over in science fiction, Planet of the Apes and things like that, right?
Right. There are more reasonable species, I guess.
Right. You know, it's an interesting read. I read it while on vacation last week, Terry, and really enjoyed it. So I hope people will pick it up, and they can get it locally, can't they?
They can. You can get it at the bookstore under Dan there.
Okooch Books in Libations. In fact, Daniel, I saw him over the weekend. He said he's got a copy there. He proudly displays local authors, which you're now a part of that group, aren't you?
I'm an author.
You might even sign a copy of it.
Yeah, I have to sign copies. Sure. I forget sometimes and give people the book and they say, oh, will you just sign it? Oh, that's right. You're supposed to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a letter in the back of the book. Are they all like that? Do all of the books have a letter that's in the envelope?
So far they do, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
okay.
I had to glue an envelope in and put this letter that I had left over that I wrote in 1971 back to the people I was working for. And I thought that would just be kind of fun to open a letter, you know, something extra in a book that books don't usually have.
Yeah, it was a nice surprise.
You know, well, that's like a Cracker Jacks.
Yeah, I waited till the end because I'm thinking, well, maybe I better get it all done, you know.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want it to be like reading the last page before you start, right?
Yeah. It could be done either way, you know. It could be a teaser if you read it first, you know, or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice little, little surprise at the end there, Terry. So, again, maybe one and done, but we'll see how it goes. Maybe you got another book in you somewhere along the line.
I should live long enough.
Yeah, right. Thanks for coming along, Terry.
Thank you. Thank you.
Terry Berg joining us on the morning show. The book is Amalgamated, and we'll talk tomorrow with more community conversation here on the morning show.